Today is Monday, December 5th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. This is News 101.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening, it's 5:09 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news. And now for our local headlines.
The BC government has agreed to fund another 80 winter shelter spaces after Mayor Gregor Robertson appealed to the provincial government last week, calling the housing situation deplorable. Housing advocate Judy Graves said shelter spaces are coming at a critical time after extreme weather response shelters were activated on the weekend. But First United Church spokesman Jason Watt said the province is still not doing enough to keep people out of the cold. Housing Minister Rich Coleman announced these seasonal spaces in addition to 42 beds set to open December 15th at Marble Arch Hotel and the 26 women-only spaces at 329 Powell Street. Friday's announcement brings the number of provincially funded seasonal spaces to 148.
Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson announced Monday he is creating a blue ribbon panel to look into the underlying issues of housing affordability. Robertson made the announcement in his acceptance speech at the inauguration of City Council. Robertson said the panel will explore ideas for how citizens in Vancouver should be able to afford decent housing. Robertson did not give a lot of details, but his staff say the plan builds on the housing affordability report the City Council approved in principle last July that laid out some ideas for how to reduce the barriers to home ownership and rentals. Robertson's Vision Vancouver party laid out a package of housing affordability ideas during the recent election. He's also planning to act on a number of those promises in the coming months.
The BC government is offering $10 million for job training projects over the next 3 years. Jobs Minister Pat Bell says business and industrial groups facing labor shortages can apply for funding under the program, with up to $500,000 available for each training project that's approved. Bell says it's important for the government to provide the tools that various business sectors can use to train the right people for the right jobs. The program is aimed at preparing the unemployed and those with few skills for jobs across the range of occupations from retail to industrial. That includes training for shipbuilding work after the North Vancouver firm Seaspan won an $8 billion federal shipbuilding contract last month. The programs could also help train heavy equipment operators and drivers for the mining industry.
Last week, the National Energy Board approved a further 27,000 barrels of oil transported daily along the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which runs from Edmonton to Burnaby. Advocacy groups, including Greenpeace and the Wilderness Committee, have expressed growing concern over the National Energy Board's decision to allow an increase in oil tanker traffic through the Burrard Inlet without public consultation. The number of oil tankers has increased from 22 in 2005 to 79 tankers last year. The National Energy Board claimed a public hearing was unnecessary because the company did not request pipeline or facility expansion. The advocacy groups are alarmed by the fact that these decisions are made, quote, entirely by stealth, and also by the fact that, according to a report by the Canada's Auditor General, oil spill contingency plans are woefully inadequate, and an increase in tanker traffic undoubtedly increases the probability of a disastrous oil spill.
The Tsilkwatin First Nation has been granted an injunction preventing Taseko Mines from conducting exploration work around its proposed gold and copper mine in BC's central interior. In the same court hearing, Taseko failed in its bid for an injunction, forcing the Tsilkwatin First Nations to stop blocking the company's access to the site outside Williams Lake, BC. BC Supreme Court Justice Christopher Grauer ruled Friday the band wasn't properly consulted on two permits granted by Taseko by the provincial government. Grauer said the First Nation will suffer greater harm than Taseko if the exploration and trail building work for the proposed New Prosperity Mine continues. The injunction will be in force until the First Nation can launch a judicial review over the provincial government permits. Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Dictionary.com defines
shindig
as an elaborate or large dance, party, or other celebration. CITR 101.9 FM defines
shindig
as 27 bands and musicians of all styles duking it out to grab one of three prize-winning top slots in a 13-week annual competition.
Shindig
2011 is underway now, with semifinals beginning November 15th and the finals set for December 6th.
Shindig
takes place every Tuesday night at the Railway Club starting at 9. With three great bands each week and audience prizes, what more could you ask for from a
shindig?
Learn more at
shindig.citr.ca.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemelin. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thank you for being with us, and it's now time for the national news. There's been a lot of controversy concerning the Omnibus Crime Bill, or Bill C-10, particularly the aspects that introduce mandatory minimum sentences for certain drug crimes and changes to young offender laws. But by the time we read this on air, the bill is likely to have been passed. Justice Minister Rob Nicholson touted the bill this morning at a news conference, encouraging all MPs to vote in favor of its passing, a vote that is set to take place this evening in Parliament, a vote that is likely to be passed through without much disruption. While campaigning for the spring election, the Conservatives promised to pass the Safe Streets and Communities Act within 100 sitting days of Parliament. Now, according to Nicholson, Canadians voted in favor of this when they elected us to a majority government, and we will deliver on the promises that we made. Maybe so, but this seems like a curious claim to make, especially when you take into account the fact that this bill is a combination of 9 previous bills that withered and died on Parliament's grapevine under the Conservatives' minority governments. Not to mention an unofficial poll conducted by the CBC, which shows more than 86% of participants opposed to the passing of Bill C-10. Recent debate has been brushed aside by the sweep of a Conservative hand. Opposition parties have been left in impotent dismay that such a major piece of legislation be rushed through Parliament. The bill passed a reporting stage last week where the Conservatives rejected amendments proposed by opposition MPs. Most House members thought they were good suggestions, mostly those relating to the bill's anti-terrorism provisions. The suggestions were so good, in fact, that the Conservatives tried to introduce the very same changes just days later. But they were shot down by House Speaker Andrew Scheer on the grounds that amendments should have been pitched at the committee, not afterwards. Which pretty much leaves the opposition MPs in a staggering rage. Many feel that this clumsy handling of the potential amendments prove that this bill is being rushed through Parliament without proper consideration. To this, the Justice Minister said, "Parliament has seen and debated these measures, some of them for as long as 4 years. The time for talk is over. The time for action is now."
In other national news, the chief of the Treble Attawapiskat First Nation in Ontario was to meet with Aboriginal Affairs Minister John Duncan today, Monday afternoon, amid calls from the opposition that the federal government must ramp up its response to the crisis on the Attawapiskat Reserve. Officials in John Duncan's office confirmed the meeting on Monday morning, but provided few other details. Chief Teresa Spence, who is in Ottawa for a meeting of the Assembly of First Nations, said she was unable to discuss details of the meeting, but confirmed she would speak with John Duncan just before 4 p.m. A meeting has been scheduled already for January 24th. That's when Prime Minister Stephen Harper, John Duncan, and Assembly of First Nations Chief Sean Atleo and other Aboriginal leaders will get together to discuss improving the social and economic situations on remote reserves like the Attawapiskat. So those are your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemelin.
Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the international news.
Peru's president has declared a 60-day state of emergency in a northern region torn by more than a week of protests against the Highland gold mine that is the country's largest investment. President Ollanta Humala said last night that protest leaders have shown no interest in reaching an agreement after a day of talks with Cabinet Chief Salmon Lerner and three other ministers. Lerner's group was accompanied by Peru's military and police chief, while guarded by hundreds of heavily armed cops. Local elected officials in the state of Cajamarca opposed the $4.8 billion Conga gold and copper mining project, in which U.S.-based Newmont Mining Corp is now a majority owner. Project opponents have said that they fear it will taint and diminish their water supply.
A long-running NASA spacecraft that's been exploring the fringes of the solar system has entered new territory. The space agency said Monday the Voyager 1 spacecraft is in a new region of the solar system that's different than what it's been studying for the past 5 years. New evidence presented at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco shows Voyager 1 has reached a point where the sun has little influence. Voyager 1 still has little ways to go before it leaves the solar system and enters interstellar space, or the space between stars. Launched in 1977, Voyager 1 and its twin Voyager 2 are hurtling in opposite directions towards interstellar space.
The man charged with attacking and blinding a UBC master's student is reported dead. Hassan Saeed Suman, who blinded his wife, UBC student Romana Manzoor, was found dead in his prison cell in Dhaka, Bangladesh, early today. Bangladeshi police are saying Suman's body was found in the bathroom of his cell at 6 a.m. local time. It is not known how Suman died, but an autopsy will be performed by officials. Romana Manzoor's horrifying tale came to light this summer. On June 5th, Suman flew into a rage and tried to gouge her eyes out with his bare hands, an attack that was witnessed by the couple's 5-year-old daughter. UBC, along with specialists, brought Manzoor back to BC after the attack in hopes of partially restoring her eyesight, but the damage was too extensive. The university has promised to help her pursue her master's degree in political science by arranging for a customized program.
In news about the Kyoto Protocol, China seems to have finally conceded to start cutting its greenhouse gas emissions, but that's not likely to change Canada's decision to pass on the second phase of the Kyoto Protocol. We've heard from Canadian officials many times that any new agreement must include all the world's major emitters of greenhouse gases. The argument for emerging countries such as China and South Africa is that to cut emissions would limit their economic growth, and are a challenge these countries didn't have to face as they grew.
Canada's chief negotiator, Guy Saint-Jacques, said that China's willingness to commit to cutting its greenhouse gas emissions starting in 2020 is an important development, although skepticism remains in many of Canada's representatives. Saint-Jacques went to say, "So far this year, in all their negotiating sessions, they have basically refused to live by the commitments in the Cancun agreements of last year. So it could be an important development that could help to move the process, and we will certainly study it with a lot of attention." But Environment Minister Peter Kent demands more details regarding China's concession, saying, "We haven't seen any detail yet. We look forward to China bringing its proposal to the conference, but with regards to Canada not taking on a second Kyoto commitment period, that would not change our position." Representatives from 194 countries are in Durban for talks on an agreement to follow up 1997's Kyoto Protocol.
Following this report, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Has been broadcasting this week from Durban, South Africa, where critical talks on fighting climate change have entered their second week at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP17. One of the key issues being debated at this conference is the future of the Kyoto Protocol. For more information on this conference and on the thousands who are marching on the streets of Durban to express their concern about climate change, we now go to a clip from Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from Durban, South Africa, where critical talks on fighting climate change have entered their second week. Key issues here at the United Nations Climate Change Conference remain unresolved, including the future of the Kyoto Protocol, the international treaty with enforceable provisions designed to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Delegates are also debating how to form a Green Climate Fund to support developing nations most affected by climate change. Meanwhile, the Obama administration's coming under intense criticism for its refusal to agree to legally binding emission cuts until at least the year 2020, despite growing scientific evidence about the worsening climate crisis. The Global Carbon Project has just revealed global greenhouse gas emissions jumped 5.9% in 2010 and have soared nearly 50% since 1990. We begin today's show in the streets of Durban. On Saturday, more than 5,000 people marched calling for climate justice. These are some of the sounds and voices from the streets of Durban, South Africa.
Nima Obasi, Friends of the Earth International. We are here to send a solid, strong message, simple message to leaders and negotiators at the Climate Change Conference that this is no time to play around. This is the time for a real commitment to cut emissions, a legally binding agreement to cut emissions at source, that rich polluting countries should understand that their inaction, the so-called cooking up of a Durban mandate, will destroy the planet, will cook Africa, and will put poor, vulnerable people in jeopardy. We can't accept that.
What is your message to the U.S. delegation?
The U.S. delegation should understand that the citizens of the United States are not living on a separate planet. We have only one planet, and it's important that the delegation from the U.S. should stop global action against global warming. They've done this from 1997. They can't keep on bullying the world. If they don't want to act, they should get out of the convention. Simple message. We can't tolerate this any further.
Oh. My name is Elizabeth Mpofu, a small scale farmer in Zimbabwe, in the central part of Zimbabwe, Mashingo province. I'm a member of an organization called Zimbabwe Smallholder Organic Farmers Forum. And now, what brought me here is because of the COP17, which is being held here in Durban, where our governments are meeting and trying to sign some agreements, but we are against some of these agreements because they are a very big challenge to our farming processes, especially when we are talking of carbon marketing, which they are intending to sign, to agree, and we are totally disagreeing with that decision. And now all these people who are today, some of them are landless people, so they are also fighting for their right to get the land, because some of this land within our countries, it's being given to the investors, the multinational, transnational corporations, the transnational corporations, which are coming to invest in our countries, yet the poor remain the poor. We are not benefiting anything. So we are on our way to the International Conference Center, where we want to send our message, to pass our messages.
I'm here in South Africa and I'm the climate change coordinator. So we're here on the streets of Durban to say that Africa needs a deal on climate change. Women here in Africa, rural women, women who depend on the land, are already seeing their weather patterns changing. They cannot grow. They cannot put food on the tables of their families. So they are saying to us, look, we've got to do something right now about climate change, because when climate change hits, it'll be them, it'll be those women who will be hit the hardest.
And what do you hope to see accomplished over the next week?
What we need to see is that Kyoto survives and there is another deal on Kyoto. We need to see rich countries in particular cutting their emissions drastically. And we need support to developing countries, people in Africa, to support them with the money to adapt to climate change.
My name's Tom Goldtooth. I'm from North America, from the belly of the beast, from occupied territories of the United States. We know what's real as far as indigenous peoples in North America. We got the escalation and expansion of tar sands and Keystone XL pipeline. We got the U.S. government pursuing expansion of fossil fuels by pursuing oil drilling in Alaska and offshore oil drilling. So it's business as usual, and what allows them to do this is carbon offsets. What they're doing is buying cheap credits in the global south, continuing to dump pollutants in the local communities, creating toxic hotspots. This is not a solution. Also, they included agriculture and soils as part of carbon. So we're here to liberate Mother Earth, to liberate the trees, to liberate the soil in the ground, to stand together with the farmers, the La Via Campesina, to stand together with the people of the world demanding real change, systemic change, not climate change.
I'm Lidina Pil. I'm from the Philippines and the organization called Jubilee South, and we're here today to demand that the rich countries cut their emissions drastically now, and that they also have to pay reparations for the climate debt that they owe our people for all the damages that climate change has caused.
And what is this float that you're taking part in right now?
Well, it's a giant octopus to represent the rich countries, like the United States. And it's showing how its many arms are pushing things like more carbon markets, pushing binding commitments but for low targets. It's also pushing a climate change regime that will result in a 6-degree temperature rise instead of limiting it to below 1.5.
We demand a recognition and respect for the way speakers, because way speakers are playing a crucial role in combating climate change. Our job, which most people doesn't recognize, it contributes a lot in emission reduction. Our work is to recycle the resources which were discarded as waste. Resources like paper, plastic, glass, cardboard and steel. These resources are extracted, transported and manufactured. So by reusing them through recycling, we reduce emissions, because if we replace the virgin materials, so that's how we contribute.
I'm Pablo Solon. I was the former ambassador of Bolivia to the United Nations, and I was the chief climate negotiator of Bolivia. I have been in Copenhagen and Cancun in the inside, and I'm here in the outside because I think the only way that we're going to be able to change the course of these negotiations is here in the outside. If people mobilize, like we are seeing now, in all countries, in a broader perspective, that's the only way we're going to be able to have deep cuts of emissions. Because what they are now promoting is a new mandate to do nothing until 2020, while the world is going to burn and Africa is going to be cooked for an increase in the temperature of more than 4 to 6 degrees Celsius.
How does the U.S. fit into this?
Oh, the U.S., I would say, it's really a shame, because their proposal on the table is only an emission reduction of 3% of the levels of emissions of 1990, and to do that until 2020. So that is mainly, let's do nothing in relation to climate change when it comes to emission reductions of the country that historically has the biggest emission reductions during the past 250 years.
I'm Patrick Bond. I teach at University of KwaZulu-Natal. I run the Center for Civil Society. The U.S. consul has been a site of several protests over the last few months by local climate justice activists, and I'm sure that by next Saturday, when this thing ends, the U.S. will be remembered as enemy one, and we'll start moving to the second step, international criminal or tribunal processes to really name the U.S., and then maybe we can get to the point where sanctions against U.S. products to punish it for basically wrecking the prospects of a deal on climate.
Voices from the streets of Durban, South Africa, at Saturday's Global Day of Action for Climate Justice, that piece produced by Mike Burke and John Hamilton. That last voice was Patrick Bond, professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and director of the Center for Civil Society. I spoke to him outside the U.S. consulate in Durban as participants in Saturday's massive march streamed past. The entrance to the consulate was surrounded by police in full riot gear. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, back in a minute here in Durban, South Africa.
That was Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! Reporting from Durban, South Africa, where critical talks on fighting climate change have entered their second week at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP17.
Those are your international headlines. For more international headlines, we shall go to Free Speech Radio News.
Nell Abram with FSI Headlines. Egyptian voters across a third of the country are finishing up elections in 2 days of runoff voting that began today. So far, turnout seems much lower than in last week's first round, which left nearly all of the contested seats in the lower parliament in play. The moderate Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party is poised to win the largest share of power, but the ultra-conservative Salafist Party, Al-Nur, stands to garner a significant block. Voters in the rest of Egypt will go to the polls in two waves, one later this month and another in early January. Opposition groups in Moscow are protesting Sunday's national parliamentary elections. Citing evidence of blatant ballot stuffing and other violations, they say the vote was rigged. Ekaterina Denilova reports.
The ruling party, United Russia, appears in early results to be led with a simple majority in parliament,
which many see as a heavy loss. But opposition parties say the results would have been worse for United Russia if the election were fair. Sergei Mironov is the head of the party Just Russia. He says their election observers gathered evidence of violations and they will formally oppose the outcome in two cities.
Our party does not accept the results of the election in St. Petersburg and Astrakhan. There was cheating and obvious falsification.
International election observers also reported broad ballot stuffing. But they noted that Russians widely took advantage of their right to vote, even though most believed the election would be unfair. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
The former president of Cote d'Ivoire, Laurent Gbagbo, made a pretrial appearance at the International Criminal Court in The Hague today. Louise Stoddard was there.
As the first international head of state to appear before the court, Mr. Gbagbo is charged on four counts of crimes against humanity, including murder, rape and persecution. The crimes allegedly took place during post-electoral violence in the Côte d'Ivoire between December 2010 and April 2011, when Mr. Gbagbo refused to accept that he was defeated in the polls. Approximately 3,000 people were killed. Dressed in a black suit, Mr. Gbagbo spoke today to confirm his name and date of birth. He also described his capture during a fierce battle in April of this year. His recent transfer to The Hague has been described as a political kidnapping by the many supporters at the court today. Ben Nyeba, from a group campaigning for the release of Mr. Gbagbo, said,
I feel great to see him, but I feel pity for the international law. I feel pity for the international law. As he's explained, he has been kidnapped and he has been lied to.
The trial is set to begin in June of 2012. Louise Stoddard, FSRN, at the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Protests marking the 27th anniversary of the world's worst industrial accident at Bhopal turned violent over the weekend. Sharia Niazi has more.
Thousands of survivors of the Union Carbide disaster at Bhopal blocked railways in India's Madhya Pradesh state. The protest turned violent after police resorted to a cane charge, lobbed tear gas shells and fired in the air to disperse the demonstrators. A number of protesters were injured and a dozen vehicles set on fire by the irate crowd. The stop train agitation was organized by a group of five NGOs working among the gas victims under the banner of International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal. The protesters demanded that the government revise death and injury figures and provide more compensation for the victims. They say the official death toll of 5,295 is far too low. Further protests were called off after Chief Minister Shivraj Singh Chauhan pledged to back the protesters' demands. Shuranyazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
A human rights activist in Ciudad Juarez is recovering from what she says was an attempt to kill her, but what authorities say was a robbery gone wrong. Shannon Young reports.
Norma Andrade co-founded the group May Our Daughters Return Home after her own daughter was killed in a wave of brutal rape murders in Ciudad Juarez. Andrade was shot five times Friday afternoon as she left her home to go to work. Investigators call it a botched carjacking. Andrade, who survived the shooting and is now hospitalized, says the attackers said nothing before walking up to her and discharging his firearm. Another of her daughters, active in May Our Daughters Return Home, left Ciudad Juarez earlier this year after arsonists set fire to her house. And another co-founder of the organization, Maricela Ortiz, fled the troubled border city after receiving direct threats via a banner hung at her workplace. May Our Daughters Return Home assists femicide victims' families and has also recently been investigating sex trafficking cases. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
More than 30 people died in multiple bomb attacks in four Iraqi areas today. All of the attacks targeted Shia pilgrims observing Ashura, an important Shia Islam holiday. In one of the attacks in Hilla, more than a dozen women and children died when a car bomb exploded alongside their procession. All auto traffic in the city was banned for the rest of the day to prevent further attacks. Other attacks took place in and around Baghdad, including one in which gunmen lobbed hand grenades at worshippers. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Over the weekend, police arrested Occupy participants in a number of cities. In Washington, D.C., law enforcement moved in on McPherson Square after occupiers made progress on construction of a barn-like shelter. Although some activists climbed on top of the wooden frame to try to save it, police used a cherry picker and inflatable cushion to get them down. The wooden frame was torn down, but tents remain. Police arrested more than 30. In Portland, Oregon, riot police arrested more than a dozen people attempting to reestablish a new encampment. A handful of people were arrested in Nashville, Tennessee and Bowling Green, Ohio. And following a 24-hour-long Occupy Broadway event in New York City, several hunger strikers were arrested twice within 12 hours, according to the Village Voice. They're trying to pressure a downtown church to let them use a vacant lot to serve as the new location of Occupy Wall Street. In California, Occupy San Francisco and Oakland are turning their attention to the housing crisis. On Saturday, Occupy San Francisco marched through neighborhoods condemning banks and landlords that exploit homeowners and renters. This week, Occupy Oakland will do the same. In Santa Cruz, protesters with the group Occupy Everything ended their four-day-long occupation of the Wells Fargo Bank building. They had hoped to turn the space into a community center. FSRN's Judith Scher has the story.
Santa Cruz police in riot gear came to the occupied Wells Fargo building on Wednesday, but left without attempting to dislodge occupants when some 180 supporters showed up. But by the weekend, activists decided on a different course of action, fearing a possible eviction by police. A man who gave his name as Bishop participated in occupying the building.
We made a decision. We were like, okay, the safety of our people is more important than this one particular building. We can go find another place. You know, the Occupy, that particular action is Occupy Everything, which is different from Occupy Santa Cruz. And so the Occupy Everything group decided that they can just go occupy something else.
But some see this as a lost opportunity, including activist Danica DeFoy, who said she had been in and out of the occupied building.
Well, you know, the bank was vacant for, I think, about 3 years. It is a former, like I said, bank property. And it is a need for a community center in this area, as well as it already being a homeless sleeping spot.
She said having to leave the building will not kill the idea behind it.
But I think, really, there's an idea here that you can't kill. And if you try to, you know, the people trying to move us may not understand that. But we've gotten into people's brains and woken them up, hopefully. And I think, too, for the first time, some people are really seeing their neighbors, and I think that's a beautiful thing.
Those who took over the bank building acted independently of Occupy Santa Cruz, which is directly across the river and home to about 100 tents. Meanwhile, another Santa Cruz group spent Saturday turning a privately owned lot that had been vacant at least 20 years into a community garden. About two dozen people spent the day cleaning up and recycling trash, building garden beds, and planting native plants and fruit trees. According to the group, police were nearby for a holiday event, but did not disturb the work. Judith Scher, FSRN.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, freespeechfsrn.org. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Now we have your weekly weather forecast brought to you By us, I guess.
By us. Presented by Martin. And I have some good news for you, because for this time of year in Vancouver, I'd say this is a pretty stellar forecast. The best you could hope for, really. Tonight it's going to plunge to -1, and that's pretty much the worst of it right there. Tomorrow, partially cloudy, mostly sun, but a high of 4 degrees. And Wednesday is the only dark spot in this entire weekday forecast. There's a 40% chance of rain, highs of 5, lows of 2. Then Thursday, Friday, right into the weekend, nothing but sunshine. Highs of 4, doesn't even go below freezing, right? Hovers around 0 degrees. And this weekend, as things stand right now, it should be partially sunny. No precipitation, no snow or hail or rain or anything like that. And it's looking like good times for all. I suggest you take advantage of it while you have the chance, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess sunbathing is out of the question, but...
Not necessarily. It depends if you... The polar bears will be out there. Polar bear clubs.
True, true.
Speaking of the polar bear clubs, this has been your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club on behalf of Martin Lemelin. Now we're going to go to the art support that was brought to us, that was sent to us by Adam Yanews. And this week he's talking about Penny Plain, which is a show going out all week long at the Kulch.
Ronnie Burkett has been working with marionettes and puppets in shows across Canada and the world for over 20 years. His latest opus is Penny Plain, and it deals with apocalyptic themes, and it's playing now at the Kulch. I spoke to Ronnie earlier today, and we talked about the unique theatrical power of these little human-like objects that we call puppets. And I ask him if puppets are easier to work with than human actors. But first, here he is with a synopsis of Penny Plain.
Yeah, it's kind of end-of-the-world apocalyptic drawing room comedy. There, how weird does that sound?
A little bit weird.
Basically, at the top of the show, we hear news announcements about, you know, all sorts of chaos in the outside world. End of oil, pandemic has struck, extreme weather. And so at the very top of the show, we know where we're sitting. And essentially, it's the last 3 days of civilization. But it's set in a rooming house run by a blind woman. Mm-hmm. And her companion dog, Jeffrey, decides he wants to go live as a man, so he leaves. And she's momentarily alone and interviews other dogs and finally chooses a human girl who's passing herself off as a dog.
Right. And I want to ask you about this theme of the apocalypse, because it's certainly been sort of in the zeitgeist, I guess, ever since the turn of the millennium. But certainly with 2012, it's sort of back in the news. I just want to know, where did you get the inspiration for this?
Well, you know, a lot of my global thinking comes from reading far too much David Suzuki, so I blame him. But beyond that, you know, I've just been increasingly aware, like most people, of two things. One, the fragility of the planet. You know, there's 7 billion of us now wanting a lot of stuff off of this planet. So that's been in my mind. And also, you know, 24-hour news keeps us pretty jacked up these days. You know, with nonstop stories about disaster. So I just kind of bought into that sort of thinking and thought, well, the world actually would do quite well without us. So it's not an end of the world piece, it's
right.
An end of civilization piece. And so my premise is, as soon as mankind gets out of the way, the planet will, you know, regenerate itself and do quite well.
Right, start to heal.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, and then let me ask you this. You've been doing this for 40 years, is that right?
I've been jiggling for money for 40 years, yeah, and Theatre of Marionettes is on its 25th anniversary tour right now. Yeah.
And when you started, as far as I know, there weren't things like The Muppet Show or Sesame Street.
Muppets were just starting, you know, when I was a kid, because they were on Ed Sullivan and all that, and of course it'd been around before me. But right when I, you know, was about 19 years old, I think, The Muppet Show hit. Mm-hmm. And so the great Muppet boom began, and puppetry took on a whole new sort of public awareness, in a way.
And did you take inspiration from that, or what was inspiration for you to get into this field?
My inspirations were a lot of old puppeteers,
yeah.
You know, guys who did marionettes. And the downside of the Muppet thing, or maybe it was an upshot for me, is that suddenly puppetry all looked like that. It was all soft and fleecy and television puppetry, which, you know, is amazing work. But suddenly, you know, doing marionettes for live audiences was considered old-fashioned, and so old-fashioned that it seemingly was new. So when I started, there weren't many people, if any, doing adult work, you know, and certainly not with marionettes. So I completely took inspiration from the Muppets by thinking, well, I don't want to do that, and I don't want to be sort of saccharine and family entertainment, and I don't really want to work on television. So it kind of allowed me to just veer off on my own track.
Now, I want to ask you about the sort of atmosphere of this kind of work, because whenever I see puppets or marionettes on the stage, that I can't help but there's a sort of eeriness to them from an audience perspective, because, you know, they're very lifelike and they're more sort of real than, say, a cartoon. And so I just wonder, what do you think is the sort of greatest asset, or what can you do to an audience using these kind of things?
Well, because those characters that are created don't exist in the real world. You know, if we go to the theater and we see a beloved actor or actress in a role, I know that I certainly always take a fair amount of time thinking, oh, I love her, and I loved her in that last thing I saw, and oh, now she's playing this Scottish lady, you know, so there's always a moment where you have to go, oh, okay, that's what I'm watching, whereas, you know, with a puppet, it's essentially an empty vessel. It exists only to be that character and honor the script in that way. So it really is, and now this sounds all woody-doody, but it really is the audience and the performer filling that iconic little thing and bringing our own frames of reference to it, and then it sort of becomes alive in a weird way, even though it's not. It's complete artifice. But it exists only to be that character, which I think is, for some people, magical.
Well, we love loody-doody things on this show.
Certainly on the West Coast, huh?
Yes, even more so. You know, we have a certain green substance that encourages us.
Grass?
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of the kind of palette, let's say, of the subject matter, I'm just wondering what kind of themes do you like to work with, or what do you like to what can you do? Because again, you say you don't necessarily do Sesame sort of family oriented stuff. Is it really anything and everything that you can deal with?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, most puppeteers, you know, certainly when they're doing adult work now, tend to veer off into fantasy or really blue material, so as it's called in showbiz still, you know. I'm not that guy who makes gargoyles and fantasy creatures. I'm more fascinated by my species, right? So what I've always done is I've used puppetry as a vehicle to shrink us and examine us in miniature. So a lot of the puppet books I grew up with when I was a kid said, never make little people. Well, screw it, I do. I make little people.
Yeah, screw that rule.
Because I think it's a great way to examine the species, you know? And like I said before, because they're not human in a way for many people, that allows them to approach without thinking, oh, that's me.
Right, almost paradoxically, you can almost see more humanity, right? Because you're not distracted by, as you say, you know, oh, I've seen this actor before, and aren't they great? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And I just want to ask you as a final note about your actors, your cast. I understand that there are costume changes and things, so it made me wonder, what are they like to work with? Are they easier than humans?
I like being alone up there, but, you know, here's the road to Weirdville. You know, I never really feel alone. Sometimes, you know, I feel like I'm in the middle of a conversation, so I just need to get out of the way so these voices coming out of my mouth can have a true conversation.
Really? And do you find that there's still a two-way street with these inanimate objects?
Absolutely. But, you know, that's why I like going to work every night, because some nights it really is magical. Some nights, and I'm... we'll never figure out that thing of how a couple hundred strangers can come together in the dark and without discussion agree to be a terrific audience. And when they do agree silently to be a terrific audience and I'm in the zone, then, you know, it really is, it's the reason I show up for work. It's magical. And other nights, they just come and cough all over me. So, and then it's a night at work, and you still have to tell the same story with the same emotional impact. But the audience, I don't think they realize how important they are to any live experience.
And that's Ronnie Burkett reminding us about the power of the audience and the part that they play in any theatrical presentation. All right, so that's Penny Plain, and that is playing right now at the Historic Theatre at The Culch, which is, of course, 1895 Venables Street at Victoria Drive. And this is running until December the 4th, as well the 6th to the 11th, and then the 13th until the 17th. Okay, so there's a lot of runnings of this show. So the best thing to do is go to tickets.theculch.com and get information on all the specific times and show dates, and also about tickets, which are $45, and they are on sale right now. So check them out, and that's tickets.theculch.com.
Well, that's our program for December 5th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us at any time. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. Today's show was produced by CJ. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening, and stay tuned for
The Jukebox.
The Jukebox. Thanks again, and have a good night.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black